On Friday, about 15 employees of High Crush Frac Sand Mining Company lose their jobs. And another 20 to 25 people, they're without work just 1 week later. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. The Trempealeau County Mine is shutting down, at least through the end of the year, and it's just one piece of the frac sand market puzzle as Wisconsin sand companies fall from the top of the list. What questions do you have about frac sand in Wisconsin? Share your experience at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He covers frac sand mining in Wisconsin. Rich, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
High Crush has announced it's halting production at that facility in Whitehall. How much detail do we have about why they're shutting down?
Well, they gave a little bit of details in their letter to the Department of Workforce Development in the state. Basically, they said that it's because of decreased profitability about the mines that are being served by the Canadian National Railway, but also more generally, it's just because of a slowdown in demand for northern white sand. And we've seen this at other mines like Superior Silica Sands up in Chippewa and Barron County, and all the mines in places like Menominee and elsewhere in the state. It's just there's an abundance of sand all over the entire country, and mines are shutting down to kind of as a response to that.
How many employees are losing their jobs? Remind us of the timeline for these layoffs from when we heard about it earlier this month.
Yeah, they're saying 35 to 40 employees. And as you said, the first round will be coming up on Friday, and then shortly after that, the second batch. And they're basically, a lot of these mines will hire different contractors to like do the earth moving or the processing of the sand or operate the wet plants, et cetera. So that's what this is. They're basically letting all of the labor go.
This may sound familiar when we're talking about High Crush, and that's because mm-hmm. It is. It's been kind of up and down this last year or so, especially for that Whitehall plant. What's the history here?
Well, the Whitehall plant announced early on this year that it was going to idle operations, but then it came back on, and it's just kind of these mines and processing facilities kind of shut down and start back up on short notice because of quick changes in the market. Some of the companies have long-term contracts with the energy producers that buy the sand, but just generally, I've in the last couple of years, there's been a massive oversupply, way more supply than any company, you know, needs. And specifically, there's been kind of a disengagement with Wisconsin white sand. That's what the industry calls our silica sand from Wisconsin, Minnesota, northern Illinois, or northern Iowa, I should say. And that's because sand from places like Texas, where a lot of the mining is going on, is much cheaper. And a lot of companies have turned to that, and other forces are at play too. There's more of an interest in really fine sand rather than what Wisconsin was kind of famous for, which is more of a coarse sand called 4070 back in the day. And when I say back in the day, we're talking way back like 2014. I'm joking because that's how fast things move in this industry.
Right, because, I mean, just a couple of years ago, we were talking about the frac sand mining boom in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Yeah, between 2012 and 2014, the number of mines in Wisconsin just skyrocketed. And that was because the price of oil was over $100 a barrel. And what that meant was you could dig sand from anywhere. You could transport it any way you needed, and you still made money. But what happened was the price of oil went down. So these energy companies and also the sand companies in Wisconsin had to figure out ways to become more and more efficient. They had to cut operation costs. So the first mines that we've seen get hit by this lack, this slowdown in demand, are the mines that are the companies that, you know, they have to truck the sand from the mine to where it's processed and then truck it again. That trucking is very expensive. So what you're seeing now is the mines that stay in operation the longest are the ones that have the mine facility right next to where it's washed, right next to where it's put on trains, because any way that they can cut overhead, it really saves them down the line.
Yeah, restricting that supply chain. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. I'm Keely Boltina, and there's room for you in this discussion. Do you live in Trempealeau County? Does this closure in Whitehall affect you personally? Maybe you've worked for Hi-Crush or another frac sand mining operation. What's going on here? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can share your story on the phone. You could email us at ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rich, this is not the only mine that was owned by Hi-Crush. Can you speak about the scope of their operations in Wisconsin and beyond the state line?
Well, I'm most familiar with what's going on in the state. They've got another mine in Augusta, which has been closed pretty much most of this year. And Augusta is in Eau Claire County. But two of their mines are operational. One is in Wyville, and the other one is in the city of Blair, which isn't far from Whitehall. And the thing that I'm trying to follow up on, and the company isn't really saying anything right now, but when they said decreased profitability with CN, Canadian National, there's Union Pacific and there's Canadian National. Those are the two major rail lines that kind of serve the heart of frac sand country in Wisconsin. And what I've heard is that Canadian National is moving away from what's known as a unit train model. And what that means is sand companies like to move things in bulk. So a unit train is 100 cars, and the whole train will be that one product. Well, there's been a shift and discussion among other carriers, too, of going from that unit train model to what's called manifest, meaning they'll put your cars in the middle of a train carrying all kinds of stuff. So your sand will be kind of dispersed throughout the train. And for frac sand mining, that's a big deal because, you know, it's all about scale. Economies of scale with them, especially when transportation costs are already so high to get the sand from places like Wisconsin to really busy oil fields in places like West Texas.
Do we know how the company is doing with those other operations in Wisconsin then?
Well, the company says Wyville and Blair are fully operational. Everything's going just fine. They didn't really get into how many tons, and there's a various investor presentations that I still need to kind of get after and pay more attention to. But they say that things are just fine at those two facilities.
Back in Whitehall, do we know how long this closure could last?
They basically said at least through the end of this year, but what I've heard from a lot of analysts that study what they oil field services, that's basically every company, every different player involved in getting the oil out of the ground, and that includes the people that supply the proppant, as it's called, or frac sand in this case. And the oversupply, I mean, I was told earlier this year that half of the mines in Wisconsin would have to close. Another analyst told me that that's a bit much, but they do figure that 30% at least right now is already shut down. And what that does is kind of helps with that oversupply.
Sure.
The less production there is, then prices creep up a little bit and everyone can kind of breathe easier. But it's a long-term problem.
WPR reporter Rich Kramer stays with us as we dig into the state of frac sand mining in Wisconsin. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a mine in your community? What do you want us to know? I'm Keely Boltina. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking about frac sand mining in Wisconsin and what it means that another company is shutting down, at least for now. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Wisconsin mines are capable of producing 100 million tons of sand every year. Right now, we're at less than 40% of capacity. What's going on in your area? What do you think about the industry? 800-642-1234. 1234 is the number to call. And WPR's reporter Rich Kramer works in Eau Claire. He's guiding us through this conversation about frac sand mining. Rich, we just talked about the fact that the plant will at least stay closed through the end of the year. What are factors that could, you know, cause it to reopen, much like it did earlier this year?
Sure. Well, there's all kinds of things at play. That's what's so fascinating about this industry and kind of hard to keep track of, is that it changes really fast. These companies are, they profit when they're able to adapt. So the things that could kind of bring it back, I guess, is if oil prices go up, then more companies that are out in the oil fields will start drilling. They'll need more sand. Another thing that's happened over the years is that energy companies have been putting a lot more sand down each well, so that's kind of increased demand a little bit. But the problem is they're
using more sand in the process of extracting the oil.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm hearing that they're putting like 2 million or more tons of sand down one of these wells. And these things go down, you know, 8,000 feet sometimes, and then thousands of feet laterally. So they found over the years, the companies have found that the more oil or more sand you put down, the more oil you can extract. And that was kind of seen as a saving grace for a while. But what happened was, you know, Wisconsin's mines built up very fast, but then things were sitting pretty for folks in Wisconsin. But then, you know, another sand boom happened in Texas and places like, you know, New Mexico and Oklahoma. And basically, companies used to look at Wisconsin sand as the best in the nation, and they were willing to pay for it. But they've found more recently that in certain applications, not all of them, sand dug up right near where the oil wells are is just fine. So that's displaced some Wisconsin sand. So, I mean, if some of those mines were to shut down and idle, that could help. But also, some of the companies in Wisconsin and the analysts I speak to, they're looking to other markets other than Texas. The Permian Basin is in West Texas. That's kind of the ground zero for most of the oil drilling activity. But Wisconsin sand, I'm told by analysts, is well suited for North Dakota. The Marcellus, which is over in the East Coast, that's where a lot of natural gas drilling is going on. There's some oil drilling activity happening in the Dakotas, and I mean in the Colorado Basin area. So those are the things that could kind of spike demand. But because there's more supply than there is demand right now, a lot of those things would kind of have to happen in sequence, it seems.
Sure, a combination. Vicky mm-hmm. from Barron County wants to share a story. Vicky, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, thank you. I'm a resident of Southern Barron County, where Superior Silica is sand mining. They have shut down quite a bit of their operation. The comment earlier was they have slowed down, and I would like to make it clear that they are bankrupt. It's been noted in the newspapers. They owe Market Johnson millions of dollars. They owe A1 Excavating, which was just in our local paper, almost $750,000. So I was present at many of our town meetings about 5 to 8 years ago when all the CEO and all these people that were pushing frac sand mining in an area and how wonderful it was going to be for our area. You know, new people would be moving in, our school district would be rich, and just, you know, none of those things have happened. In fact, we have empty buildings or homes around frac sand mining, which are difficult to sell. People can't sell them, so then the frac sand mine will buy them up. Our school district taxes have actually went up since frac sand mining, and it has affected our local revenue base. It's not a steady job for many of the people that work there. I'm also worried about the safety of the silica dust in the air with a company that's bankrupt. So I'm just, in many of the promises that they gave, I would say hardly any of them have happened.
Vicki, thank you for sharing your story. Rich, a lot of concerns there that Vicki was able to lay out for us. Have you heard this in these communities near frac sand mines?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad Vicki did point out that the bankruptcy happened. That was kind of, to me, it seemed like a real foreshadowing of what could be happening in Wisconsin, because Superior Silica Sands, owned by Emerge Energy, is seen as one of the major players. But they're one of those companies that use a lot of transportation. So they have trucks that haul the sand from the mine to the processing facility. Then they haul the wet sand to a drying plant that loads it up on rail. And that adds a lot of cost. But what she's right. When these companies came to the local towns and the places that they were courting for permits, we heard constantly that these things would be around for 30 to 50 years. And what we've seen is that's not necessarily the case. They may be around that long, who knows, in general, but they are kind of a boom and bust sort of an industry chasing another boom and bust industry. So very volatile.
Rich Kramer I'm sorry, hang on just a moment. We have another call. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about frac sand mining operations in Wisconsin, and Ron from Norwalk wants to share his experience. Ron, welcome to the morning show. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. Yes. I used to work in North Dakota, and I have many friends out there that still live there, and they keep track of the Bakken. And the comment that the guest just made as far as the boom and bust is really, really true. I know when my friends in the Bakken say that they're cutting down on wells, it's not even a week later, there's layoffs here. Well, the plant that's closest to me is in Sparta, Wisconsin. And I think it's Smart Sand. I'm not positive on that, but it's really boom and bust. And it really affected our area here when they discovered the sand down in Texas, where a lot of our sand was going down to. And they have a big sand play down there. And that really cut back again on our sand mining here. Plus, I had heard, I don't know if your guest knows anything about this, but that they're looking at manufacturing like an artificial type of sand that would be used in this sort of industry. So if that happens in any sort of scale, it's really going to affect our sand mine. So it is just like the oil industry. It's boom and bust, and it's tough on communities. It's like one of the previous callers said, you know, it's just, even in the oil fields, that's boom and bust. It's hard on those communities too, because a bunch of people come in, they don't have the infrastructure ready for them, and then all at once the price falls and everyone goes away, and it's just a kind of a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
A lot of money to be made, but boy, it's fraught.
Ron, thank you so much for that. Rich, it sounds like Ron is really familiar with that, all of those factors that you've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And a couple of things I wanted to follow up on. So the Smart Sand, it's a really interesting case. It's a company that is located down in that area, and they've gone public, and their stock price has gone down like a lot of the other sand companies, but Smart Sand seems to be kind of holding its own for now. I haven't heard of any layoffs at any Smart Sand plants, and in fact, they're seeking a permit to build a new mine in, I want to say it's in Trempealeau County near Hixton, but they say they're not going to immediately start mining. What they talk about reserves, so they know that that a piece of property has so many hundreds of millions of tons in reserves, so they'll buy it and kind of keep it in their back pocket. North Dakota is fascinating. What happened there? I had friends that worked out there in the oil fields, and just like almost overnight, that place went from just kind of not much going to just a crazy. It was like the Wild West as far as the number of people, the number of generally men going there to work, just a lot of activity. And then it kind of stopped. And I mean, there's still drilling going on there, but the problem with the wells in North Dakota, from what I'm told by analysts, is that they're very expensive to operate. It takes a lot of money to be able to get oil out of it, and it doesn't really make sense unless oil prices are over $100 a barrel. Well, now they're between $50, $60, maybe $70 a barrel. So with margins that are tighter, it only makes sense to drill where oil is easiest to get. And for the most part, that's kind of down in West Texas right now.
All right. Diana from Preston called, said that there's a high crush plant near her. Diana says that she's happy to see it go, but she does feel sorry for people losing their jobs. Rich, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and he covers frac sand mining in Wisconsin. Up next is news, then an expert shares her research on how marijuana use can impact brain development, especially for younger teens and adolescents. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. As lawmakers in Wisconsin weigh legalizing marijuana in any form, they're talking about research into the health effects of the drug, namely that it's not particularly extensive. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring what we do know with the leader of a program focused on how marijuana changes developing brains. What are your questions about how marijuana research is done or what we're finding? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ideas@WPR.org is our email. Stacey Gruber is the director of the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Corps at McLean Hospital. She heads the hospital's MIND program, which studies marijuana and the brain. Gruber is also an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Stacey, welcome to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
What do we know about how adolescent marijuana use can affect the brain? Just where do we start?
It's a great question. Where do we start, since it's been around for thousands and thousands of years? What we know about marijuana or cannabis, first of all, we have this one term, and we use it to describe anything, basically, that comes from the plant. But when we're talking about adolescents or emerging adults, folks for whom the brain is not fully developed, it's a specific concern. People are concerned not just about marijuana, but other drugs and alcohol. But with regard to marijuana, what we know is that individuals who begin using marijuana or cannabis early on, that is, when the brain is still, I like to say, under development or under construction, these folks wind up having some more difficulties with tasks requiring what we call frontal function or executive function relative to those who begin using later or those who don't use at all. So early use, especially in high amounts and with great frequency, seems to be correlated with some clear difficulties in certain cognitive domains. That's the first thing. We've also seen some evidence for changes in brain structure and brain function in folks who use cannabis specifically during adolescence or emerging adulthood, again, relative to those who use later or who don't use at all. Doesn't mean they can't do these tasks. It means that they look different, and they may have some more difficulties relative to people who don't use or, again, who use later.
So what is it about adolescents that makes them more vulnerable to abusing marijuana than adults?
So the brain develops throughout the second and into actually the third decade of life, and it sounds like a very, very long time because really it is, and it develops from the back to the front and the bottom to the top. The very last part of the brain to become fully developed is the frontal cortex, the area just behind your eyebrows, and that's a critical area for inhibitory processing, sort of knowing when you should and shouldn't do certain things, the ability to utilize feedback to change your behavior, to make good, sound decisions, sort of these characteristic, what we call executive functions, that are classic signs of an adult. This area is still very, very much, again, under development during adolescence. And that's without alcohol or drugs or illness or injury. So when you introduce something like cannabis or marijuana, the potential for disruption in the normal developmental process is much higher. So the brain is vulnerable during this period to lots of things, but with regard to exposure to marijuana, it's very likely that that exposure changes the ways in which the brain winds up developing.
And we're talking just about recreational use here, right? Not medical.
Correct.
That makes a difference.
Thank you so much for making that distinction, because I'm very fond of saying recreational or adult use cannabis is not the same as medical cannabis use, not even close.
Okay. And the difference is regulation, potency. There are a lot of different factors.
The primary differences between medical and recreational cannabis use come down to the intention for use, which dictates the product choice, actually. So intention for use for recreational consumers to alter their current state of being, to get high. So they're looking for products that are particularly high in Delta-9 THC, the primary constituent of the plant that, quote, gets you high. Medical cannabis users are typically looking to simply alleviate symptoms or to feel better. They say, Dr. Gruber, I don't want to be high, I just want to feel better. They're looking for products that may have THC, but are also noted for other cannabinoids, like we've often heard a lot about cannabidiol or CBD. There's lots of other constituents, CBC, CBN, many of them non-intoxicating that also have very great potential for health benefits. So that's one big difference. Potency, you know, recreational products and medical products are often exactly the same product, but they're used differently. And again, with a different goal.
Let's bring in Bernie from Elkhorn this morning. Bernie, what did you want to say about our conversation about marijuana use in adolescence?
Good morning. There should not be marijuana use except if there's a medical reason for adolescence. That's a parental issue, and you know, it just shouldn't be, just like adolescents shouldn't be drinking alcohol. But I do have the concern that a lot of times the argument, the truthful argument that adolescents should not be using marijuana for recreational purposes gets involved in the argument about whether or not marijuana should be legal for adults. And I think it's important to remember that alcohol should be legal for adults, but minors shouldn't be using it. Similarly, marijuana should be legal for adults, but children and minors shouldn't be using it. Two completely different issues.
Bernie, thank you for that perspective. Stacy, Bernie's really talking about treating the substance differently based on age, and that's kind of what your research looks like.
That's exactly right. And Bernie, thank you very much for such a thoughtful comment. And, you know, again, this is not to condone use by all adults for everything. That's not up to me to do. but the truth of the matter is, someone once said, you know, if alcohol were discovered today, it would probably fall on Schedule 1, like cannabis or marijuana tends to. So, again, these things are in that case, actually federally illegal. But when we think about legalizing for adult or recreational use, the question of the age at which that becomes okay to do is critical. And adolescents and emerging adults are not legally allowed to use things like alcohol or other substances. So, you know, your point is well taken. Whether or not you agree with legalizing for adult use, we certainly are mindful of the fact that adolescents are vulnerable, not just to cannabis or marijuana, but to alcohol, to other drugs, to illness, to injury. The brain is very, very vulnerable. So it's a great point.
Stacy Gruber heads a program in Massachusetts studying how marijuana affects the brain, and she's also an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're taking your calls. Have you used marijuana? Did you or your friends start as teenagers or even earlier? What impact do you think that had as you grew older? 800-642-1234. Stacy, an important factor here is when someone starts using marijuana, and you are looking at the age of 16 as our pivot point. What have you found between people using marijuana before 16 and after? What's the difference?
So basically, the studies that we had found in the literature looked at either 16 or 17, so that was one of the reasons we chose that age. It wasn't as if there were some magic thing that happened at 16, although it does dovetail with when kids are in high school, sort of typically sophomore year, and they're often confronted with these decisions about whether to engage or not engage in different types of behaviors, including cannabis use. What we find is that individuals who use regularly, that is a regular pattern of use prior to the age of 16, specifically those who use high amounts of cannabis, so they're using frequently, 4 or 5 days a week, sometimes multiple times a day, those folks tend to look different from the individuals who use later, when the brain is more fully developed, specifically on tasks requiring what we call frontal function, so the ability to inhibit inappropriate responses, the ability to make good decisions in the face of competing demands, to utilize feedback to change your behavior. We also see changes in patterns of brain activation during tasks requiring these types of things. And we see some changes in what we call white matter microstructure or white matter integrity. White matter allows good, clean transmission from one brain region to the next. And in our early onset users, specifically those with heavy use, we see some changes in coherence, that is, lower white matter coherence that's correlated with behavioral impulsivity. So the earlier you start using cannabis, the lower the white matter integrity. The lower the white matter integrity, the higher the self-reported impulsivity. So that's a really important relationship to identify, especially since it's only present in the early onset users. We didn't see that in those who started after 16.
But we see recreational marijuana legal, decriminalized in about a dozen states. And there's a legal age standard that different places are creating of 21 or older being allowed to access it. But brain development continues for longer than that. And you're also saying that the biggest effects are before 16. What is it about this age that's working or isn't for us, I guess?
Again, you know, as since we develop, again, throughout the lifespan, there are changes, right, in the brain. And our brain does continue to develop throughout the second, and some have hypothesized even the beginning of the third decade of life. So that's a long time to ask people to not engage in certain behaviors. You know, what we know about states where we have legalized cannabis use and the age is 21, you know, some people say, well, 21 is you know, you're legally an adult. I always like to point out the example of Hertz and Avis or any rental car company that assigns a very high surcharge for individuals who are under the age of 25. You actually have to pay a much higher price to rent a car. Why is that? Because the risk associated with drivers under the age of 25 is significantly higher. So I always like to joke, I'd like to be the neuroscientist who helped those folks make that decision, because in many ways that's a very, very wise one. People have identified 25 as a slightly more appropriate age to allow people to start thinking about using substances like cannabis. That doesn't mean states will change their laws, nor am I suggesting it. It's a sort of funny comparison when you think about it. You can do all sorts of things at 18 and 21 that may not necessarily correlate with your brain's developmental trajectory. So at 16, we are still very much, quote, under construction, even more so at 14 or 12, which we also see as an age that people are beginning to use cannabis. So it's important to be mindful.
And we know that a bill introduced here in Wisconsin actually deals with tobacco products, looking at raising that age to 21. Tobacco is obviously a different drug, but it's still we're still hanging it on that age 21.
Sure, it's a really tough thing for people to understand, and some people think 21 is the right age. Again, you know, there's a different metric, if you will, between looking at things like brain development and hallmarks of brain development versus the legal age at which someone can vote or do other things. So it's an interesting set of questions to pose. The important thing to remember is that this isn't just about marijuana. It's about the fact that the brain is still vulnerable. And at 21, we may still have some vulnerabilities that we don't have when we get a little bit older.
Stacy Gruber is the director of the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Corps at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. We're talking about how marijuana use changes the brain, especially among young people. And we're taking your calls. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Researchers are trying to figure out exactly what kind of long-term damage marijuana use can cause. And it turns out it could be different depending on a person's age. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. How do you think states should handle age limits for marijuana based on its health effects? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Stacy Gruber studies how marijuana affects the brain, and she leads McLean Hospital's MIND program in Massachusetts. Let's welcome Jim in La Crosse to the conversation this morning. Jim, good morning.
Well, good morning. I just wanted to say I've been a cannabis user for probably 50 years. I was blown up in a feed mill, so I have my body's a wreck. And that's about the only thing that I've used. Mm-hmm. And I've tried everything, mm-hmm. Literally, mm-hmm. So I can get some sleep at night. I do agree with you at age 25. I think that's the age that when they should be able to start buying it. I don't agree with even alcohol at less than 25, but that's just my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Jim, thank you so much for sharing that. What do you hear there, Stacey?
So what I hear, and again, thanks so much, Jim, for sharing that. It's so important for people to remember that cannabis or marijuana for medical purposes is very different from recreational cannabis for kids. They're very, very different topics. And the reason that I started the MIND program, Marijuana Investigations for Neuroscientific Discovery, is exactly because of people like Jim. Because we have no data on the efficacy or long-term effects of medical cannabis. I scoured the literature and couldn't find anything at all to demonstrate what we had been hearing anecdotally for years, that individuals who are using cannabis for medical purposes felt better and actually seemed to be doing better. And sure enough, our preliminary data from this program underscores exactly what he's saying, which is that folks who are using cannabis, and again, depends on the products and what's, quote, what's in the weed, how much CBD, CBN, THC, all that stuff, really is likely to make a difference in terms of short and long-term outcome. But what we're seeing are improvements. It is exactly opposite pattern of what I see in our younger recreational users is what I see in our adult medical cannabis users. After 3 months of initiating cannabis, and again, we look at these folks when nothing is on board before they begin using, so they're naive. We follow them out for up to 2 years. We see them at 3, 6, 12, 18, and 24 months. We talk to them monthly. We have samples of their products analyzed by an outside lab. And by and large, what we're seeing are very significant improvements in cognitive performance. The same areas that we're seeing some difficulties in our early onset users as adolescents, we're seeing improvements. We're seeing symptom alleviation, improved sleep, decreased conventional medication use, specifically the use of opioids, drops rather precipitously after only 3 months. So this is a very, very important note and a distinction that really should be made between recreational and medical cannabis. And, you know, for folks who are looking for alternative or adjunctive therapy, cannabis has become a real viable alternative. We still don't know everything we need to know, but I'm delighted that we're actually seeing some real demonstrable proof of potential clinical benefit in at least some folks. We need clinical trials, which we've already begun here finally. So that really does help us.
I'm Keely Boltina talking with Stacey Gruber. She leads a program researching changes in the brain when people use marijuana. A caller who couldn't stay with us said she started smoking marijuana at 13. She says she thinks the health effects come down too much to the individual, and she worries that research into the topic is too skewed. Stacey, how do you ensure efficacy in the research that you're doing?
It's another really great point. And for many, many moons, people really did only focus on the potential negative effects of using cannabis. There was no huge push to look at the potential benefit or clinical or therapeutic use of cannabis. For those who begin using at age 13, there may be no difficulties at all long term for some. And for others, we clearly see some difficulties. And so your caller is right. It's a very individual experience. People are different. What else happens in that individual's life also makes a difference. Their nutritional status, what else they use, alcohol, drugs, all sorts of life experiences. Everything weighs in. So it's not as if we're saying absolutely everybody who uses cannabis early on will develop a terrible problem. That's not what this is about. I think in terms of doing good sound research, you get large numbers of individuals and you follow them. There's a national initiative called the ABCD program, and actually there's a node at University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So this study is designed to look at over 10,000 healthy 9 and 10-year-olds and follow them for 10 years. And in this way, you can actually identify sort of correlates between lots of different substances that people use and other things, of course, and changes in brain structure, function, cognitive performance, etc. That's really the best way to figure out whether the cannabis did or didn't necessarily weigh into any difficulties people have. You have to actually have a longitudinal approach and identify things before people begin using and then follow them out over time. Certainly not everybody develops a problem. Absolutely true.
James from Racine is looking for some specifics. James, what's your question this morning?
I was curious how you guys were gathering the data regarding this. Were you guys like using the children or not, you know, the adolescents' own, like, are they just telling you how much they're using, or how are you guys getting all this information?
So different modes of data acquisition depending on the studies. For the recreational cannabis studies, these are individuals who are typically in their early 20s. It goes all the way down to 12, but there's a wide age range. And it, yes, it's all self-report. These are people who are still using cannabis and report sort of their lifetime use. So they have a full clinical and diagnostic assessment, which means that we sort of take a world tour through their life, specifically with regard to their substance use, primarily cannabis. First time they used, how often they used, how they use, with whom, what types of products, how much they use. We have a method of quantifying, because cannabis is not the easiest thing to quantify with regard to how much people are using, depending on whether they're using conventional flower or extracted oils, dabs, you know, shatter wax, all these things matter. So it is individuals actually coming in and being assessed face-to-face. It's not a survey or anything. So they're able to, we walk people through their history, and they can quantify for us how much they use in a given week, when they started, how long they've been using, how they use, etc.
Dave from Milwaukee has a question for us, too. Dave, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for taking my call. So my question is basically, have there been any studies, or probably more animal studies, that have looked at whether it's the cannabis that changes the developmental...
Dave, you're breaking up a little bit.
With... Oh, sorry. Is it the cannabis that is changing the executive function in adolescents, or are there adolescents that are, for whatever reason, less cognitively developed, have lesser executive function, that then use cannabis more often?
Chicken or the egg.
Yeah, great question. And actually, that sort of dovetails back with what I had just said about that national initiative, the ABCD project, which is a longitudinal look at a giant number of kids over time. And in this way, you're actually looking at people before they ever begin using, so you can answer that question. I will tell you that in preclinical studies, it's not, quote, cannabis per se necessarily, but Delta-9 THC, the primary intoxicating constituent, has been identified as being associated with cognitive decrements. The administration, sort of in an acute and a longer-term way, does appear to be associated with poorer cognitive performance. So that's very likely the constituent, or one of the constituents, involved here. But, you know, I think we will have some real data from ABCD in just a few years, so that will help answer the question. It's a great question, though.
Stacey, where does research go next? What's the biggest question remaining?
So I think there are a number of areas with regard to the recreational or adult use cannabis realm, in terms of what we know about concentrated products. So products that are designed to have north of 40, 50, 80, 90% THC versus our former sort of conventional flower products that had somewhere between 4% and now about 17 or 18% THC. We don't really have great data on what that looks like long term, or modes of use, whether people are vaping or smoking versus other modes of administration. In the medical cannabis realm, I think there are some similar questions to be posed, but much more in depth with regard to the individual constituents of cannabis, that is the cannabinoids and other compounds from the flower, from the plant rather, and how they actually may exert a beneficial effect without necessarily imparting intoxication. So there's lots of work to be done, for sure.
Stacey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Stacey Gruber is the director of the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Corps at McLean Hospital. She's also an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Gruber heads McLean Hospital's MIND program, which studies how marijuana impacts the brain. And tomorrow, we continue our conversation on some related notes. At this time, we're talking about the health effects of hemp products, understanding CBD, and looking at a new research project about growing hemp in Wisconsin. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network.